She swallowed and turned her head, but not before he caught the glimpse of sorrow in her eyes.
"If you choose not to keep his things, please let me know. There are so many of us who will be happy to take them for you."
The hand that brushed the desktop trembled, sending a pulse of compassion through him. Unfamiliar, the feeling caught him by surprise. He had a desk, one he'd had custom built to accommodate his height years before. But the very idea of putting more sadness in her eyes was suddenly untenable. "I'd consider it an honor to keep the office as it is, Caroline." Her relief was a tangible thing. "I may, however, require some additional furniture." He turned and took in the square footage. "I have a footstool for my leg," he added, his brows drawing together slightly. To her credit, she didn't flinch or look uncomfortable in the least. His opinion of her inched up another notch. "And a computer table."
"I'll take care of it. Are they still in Denver?"
"No, they're in my house in Wheaton, about an hour drive from town." Caroline looked up at him, surprised.
"You have a house in Chicago already?"
"My grandmother's. She left it to me a few years back. But one of my nephews has been living there, keeping the place up. He was offered a job on the East Coast and moved last week. Hearing from Dean Whitfield was, providential." He thought of Denver, of the pain of leaving behind what he'd never really had. Coming to Chicago now was providential indeed.
"Well, fine. If you give me the address, I'll arrange for the furniture and anything else you want to be moved here."
She hesitated, those eyes of hers blurting uncertainty.
"What else would you like me to do for you today?"
Max lifted his eyebrows. "I've never become chair of a department after its founder died unexpectedly. What would you recommend?" He watched her draw a relieved breath. What kind of man had she expected him to be? It was unlikely his reputation could have preceded him this quickly.
"Well, I have personnel files and the department budget for you to review."
She started ticking the items off on her fingers.
"And you have to sign payroll today or the natives will revolt. I have your schedule prepared. You have your first class tomorrow morning at 9:30. Eli had notes prepared for the whole semester. You can use his or your own, of course. You have meetings set up with your staff beginning at 1:30 today, ending at 5, and a dinner with Dean Whitfield at 6. He'll send a car for you. Then all the student files, of course, and..."
"Whoa, stop." Max held up a hand in mock surrender. "First things first. Is there any way I can get some coffee? I'm still on Denver time." Her dimple returned.
"I'll make us some. How do you take it?"
"Cream and sugar. Lots of sugar. If you order me a coffee maker, I'll make it myself and not bother you with it." He moved to sit behind the desk, taking pressure off his hip. "And Caroline?" She turned at the door of his office and he looked, unable to keep his eyes locked on her pretty face any longer. She was as appealing coming as she was going, he decided swiftly. Clad in a casual black skirt, she was the picture of uncontrived femininity. The color of her blue turtleneck sweater brought out the deep blue of her eyes and gently molded what appeared to be very nice breasts. The palms of his hands itched as his eyes measured. She was the perfect size, enough to cradle in his hands, but not too large. He'd always preferred women with rounded figures. Caroline Stewart's figure was simply perfect. The skirt hugged slim hips and fell to mid-calf, where sheer stockings covered the rest of her very nice legs. Her shoes were sensible, with not a single zing of flash, yet they showcased her calves to perfection. He abruptly yanked his eyes back to her face. She was watching him steadily, interest sharpening her expression by degrees. And it was interest he saw in her face. The good kind. He'd been out of the mainstream a long time, but not so long that he didn't recognize the look of a woman aware of a man. sincerely, honestly, wholesomely aware. Wholesome. The very word startled him as it appeared in his mind. A decision snapped into place, one he'd probably analyze to death later. But it was a new start, a second chance, and he'd begin today to honor his self-made resolution to meet life with spontaneity. Caroline's personnel file would be the first he'd read, her marital status the first line he'd search for. And if she wasn't married, he would ask her out. It was as simple as that. Caroline felt a rush of heat slide up her neck as he looked her up and down. She realized her mouth was watering, and she swallowed hard as the passage of time became clear once more. She'd been standing there staring at him for at least a minute. He'd addressed her, although what they'd been talking about suddenly became a fuzzy memory.
Yes?
She knew his smoky gray eyes were sizing her up, and the knowing made her tremble deep inside as she wondered about his conclusions. He was a very attractive man. She bit back the frown. And he was her boss. Tricky and very dangerous waters. Pour yourself a cup of coffee and join me. The first thing I want to do is to get to know you. Caroline found him 20 minutes later sitting at Eli's desk, surrounded by stacks of Eli's books. No, she corrected herself, feeling the pain of loss once again. Sitting at Max's desk, surrounded by stacks of Max's books. It was an important distinction, and she would need to remember it daily. Clearing her throat, she set the tray on the corner sideboard.
Here's cream and sugar. I'll let you at it yourself this time, then I'll know for the future.
Max's brows drew together in the first full frown she'd seen. I meant what I said about the coffee, Caroline. Your job is not to fetch my coffee. I'm perfectly capable of getting it myself. She blinked and sat down in the chair opposite his desk, cradling her own cup in both hands. She had the distinct impression his desire to get his own coffee had nothing to do with secretary's rights and everything to do with proving the cane was not an obstacle. Either reason would be fine with her. She certainly understood the drive to prove a disability was not disabling. With a shrug, she said,
"Works for me. But will you reject my cream puffs, too?"
The frown faded abruptly. Cream puffs? From scratch? She hid her grin behind her coffee cup. Evidently, this gorgeous man had a weakness for sweets.
On the tray. From scratch.
Pure appreciation dominated his features as he took the first bite. I'll make you a deal, Caroline. I'll bring the coffee, and you bring the pastries. He licked his fingers, the motion sending little pulses through Caroline's body. They were similar to the pulses she'd felt the first few times she and Dana drooled over the Diet Coke Guy commercial. But these new pulses were a whole lot stronger than that. And the way his smoky eyes focused on her face. She took a gulp of coffee, wincing when it scalded her throat on the way down. So, he leaned back in his chair and studied her face. Tell me about yourself. Caroline shrugged again, uncomfortable under his scrutiny.
There's not much to tell, I'm afraid. I've been here for almost 7 years, working as the office manager and Dr. Bradford's secretary. I do what needs to be done, and work on my degree in whatever time's left over.
So you're a student, too?
I'm one of your students. Constitutional monarchy. I hear you do a great Magna Carta.
You'll have to tell me once you see it. Con Mon is a graduate-level course. He leaned back in his chair. So you're a grad student, then?
No, still working on my bachelor's. Con Mon was just for fun, and I'm just taking it as an audit, not for credit.
She grew wistful.
I wanted to have Eli for a teacher one last time. I graduate at the end of spring quarter.
And then what will you do? Her chin tilted up a fraction of an inch.
I've been accepted to law school at U of I.
His head angled slightly to one side. University of Illinois Law School. Good for you. Will you continue working here once you've completed your bachelor's?
His simple praise made her want to blush, and she never had been able to control her tendency to blush. It was just her cross to bear. She shifted in her seat, crossing her legs, noting his eyes quietly following her every move. Mercy.
Well, our plan was for me to work part-time and Evie to pick up the slack, but Eli took care of that.
She caught her voice wavering and swallowed hard. The very notion that Eli had remembered her in his will was still enough to move her to tears. He'd given her so much over the years. And now...
He left me enough to pay for school and my expenses, so Evie will take over all my responsibilities when I graduate.
Evie?
Yes, Evie Wilson. She's my aide now, but Eli agreed she'd be ready by the time I graduate.
Max watched her eyes warm at the mention of her aide. There was fondness there, no doubt, but he spoke his mind nonetheless.
No offense against Dr. Bradford, but I'll need to decide that for myself.
Then, in fascination, he watched her blue eyes flash, matched sapphires against her ivory skin.
And a little temper she has, too, he thought, finding the notion rather stimulating. I did say no offense, Caroline.
The flash immediately quieted, and she dipped her head, drawing an uneven breath.
I'm sorry. Of course you will.
She straightened in her chair, lifting her gaze again.
So, what else do you want to know?
Will you go out to dinner with me tomorrow night? He wanted to ask, but held the question back.
Given her attachment to Dr. Bradford, he'd give her a little time to become accustomed to his presence. Then he'd be spontaneous, he promised himself.
Where do you come from?
Caroline controlled the urge to flinch, blinking instead. As prepared as she was, the question still threw her. She despised the need to invent a past, but it was necessary. Still. Always.
I was born in St. Louis.
So the information on her borrowed birth certificate maintained.
But my parents moved around a lot while I was growing up.
It helped explain away the North Carolina twang that she'd never been able to completely annihilate.
Your father was in the military?
Caroline shook her head.
No, they just moved around a lot. I ended up dropping out of school before graduation.
That much was true. She'd been pregnant with Tom and so scared at the time.
So when I came to Chicago, I got my GED and got a job working in a warehouse while I improved my secretarial skills at night.
It had been so hard working in a warehouse, lifting boxes weighing nearly as much as she did. Her back injury still plagued her in those days, and she used a cane to get from her little apartment to the bus stop and then on to work. So many nights she'd cry herself to sleep from the pain. It was only sheer determination, Dana's constant pushing, and the thought of her son growing up in poverty that made her practice her typing in shorthand until her back ached and her eyes burned.
Then I met Eli. He offered me a job, and I've been here ever since.
Max opened her personnel file on top of his stack. She waited until his eyes widened, knowing he'd found the mention of Tom.
And I have a 14-year-old son.
His gray eyes registered surprised interest as he did the mental calculations. Thus, the dropping out of school. You couldn't have been more than... Her chin lifted.
I was 16 when he was born.
He held his gaze steady to her face. And soon you'll have your degree. I hope your son appreciates what he has in you. She immediately softened.
Tom is a good boy. I'm very proud of him.
So was Dr. Bradford from these notes. Max closed the file and picked up his cup. So, you'll be a lawyer. He winced in mock dismay. Gonna be a corporate shark? Caroline laughed out loud,
startling a smile from his gray eyes.
Oh, no, not me. I'm going to practice family law.
She'd represent the battered women, the women whose successful husbands left them for younger women, leaving them no visible means of support. She'd represent them, and she'd win. You'll never be a millionaire.
No, but I'll have my self-respect.
His eyes flickered for a moment, then dropped to the next file. So tell me about the rest of my staff. I'll start with Wade Grayson.
He helped Eli start the history department here at Carrington. He's a U of I...
No, I can read all that for myself. Tell me about him. Caroline regarded him soberly for a long moment.
Wade's a good man. Kind. Gentle. He'd give you the shirt off his back if he knew you had a need. He's brilliant and totally unassuming. He and his wife still live in the apartment they had when he first earned his tenure. They play canasta every week with friends they've had for years.
Max made a note on the inside cover of the file.
What did you just write?
Max looked up, meeting her sober expression with equal reserve. That he's loyal. She nodded, pleased.
You are correct.
He lifted his brows. That's why I'm the department chair. It had the desired effect, making her laugh aloud again. She had a beautiful laugh, and he wanted to hear it often. They reviewed three more professors and six grad student assistants before he reached the last file in his stack. Now, how about Monica Shaw? The smile abruptly disappeared, Caroline's face going still as a stone. Well, that was telling, Max thought. She sat there, obviously choosing her words with great care. He sat, waiting patiently, curious as to how political she could be.
Dr. Shaw is...
She hesitated, sighed, then began again.
Dr. Shaw is very thorough.
He waited, then frowned when she folded her hands in her lap, her full lips pursed in a thin line. And?
That's about all.
That can't be all, Caroline. She frowned back, going rigid in her chair.
That's all you're going to get from me.
Then that says quite a lot. Her tight-shouldered shrug said even more.
Please, Dr. Hunter. Max,
she added when his mouth opened to correct her.
Please don't ask me to add any more. Just like with Evie, you'll have to make your own assessments about all of us, me included. I don't want to be bearing tales on your first day.
He wondered if she was aware that her speech thickened when she was agitated. She practically twanged. Under other circumstances, he would have found it charming, but now he could only hear her dismay. All right. He fought the wave of disappointment that threatened when she rose. That's enough for one day. When do I meet her?
Who?
Dr. Shaw. A myriad of emotions played across her expressive eyes. The anger and resentment he fully expected, but the self-doubt in her eyes threw him. Monica Shaw made Caroline feel inferior. It was plain to see. Somehow, that made Max very angry.
You'll meet her at 2:30. If you need anything else, just call.
Sevier County, Tennessee, Monday, March 5th, 3:30 p.m. Winters approached the Sevier County's police garage slowly, every step harder than the one before. He had been in Asheville's garage hundreds of times, maybe thousands over the course of his 14-year career with the Asheville PD. But always before, it had been in the line of duty. Today, he pushed open the heavy steel door, his heart rate taking an upward spike. Today, he'd see the last place his son had been before he'd been taken from him. Winters couldn't bring himself to say the words that marked the finality of his Robbie's fate. The smell of oil hit him with full force. How did the mechanics manage to stay conscious in this place? Ventilation was non-existent. He took one last deep breath of semi-fresh air and made his feet move. Four cruisers sat in a row, waiting for maintenance. The rest of the place was filled with a dozen assorted vehicles, from a classy red Corvette to the mud-covered Ford he recognized the gut-wrenching instant his gaze landed on it. The head mechanic's name was Russ Vandalia.
"Vandalia," he called,
hoping the mechanic wasn't here, hoping he'd get one shot at examining the car before anybody else. He wanted evidence. He wanted clues. He wanted the bastard that had kidnapped his precious son and sent him to the bottom of Douglas Lake.
"Yeah, what do you want?"
Vandalia responded in a quiet voice, emerging from behind a car 10 feet away, grime covering his wizened old face, one grizzled cheek bulging from a wad of chew.
"Can I help you?"
Vandalia turned to discreetly spit in an old Maxwell House can.
"I'm Detective Rob Winters, Asheville PD.
Vandalia studied him for a long moment, then nodded.
"Thought you might be showing up soon."
He turned, without another word, down the aisle between the parked cars. A few Chryslers, a minivan with the front smashed in, an assortment of Japanese cars, the fire engine red Corvette. Vandalia patted the Corvette as he passed.
"Drug bust up I-40, he commented. "I'm gonna be front row and center when they auction off this lady."
Finally, he came to the dirtiest car in the garage. The license plate had been wiped clean, but Winters didn't need to look. He knew it by heart. That license plate had been on the APB list of every force in the Carolinas and three states over. He himself still looked for it every time he was on the road. Of course, he never would have seen it. Nobody would have seen it. It had obviously been at the bottom of Douglas Lake a long, long time. He stood looking at the car until Vandalia cleared his throat.
85 Tempo. It's yours, Detective. Sevier County ran a check on the plates and the serial ID yesterday morning as soon as they fished her out. Rolled in here yesterday afternoon.
Did you find anything inside? He heard himself ask. Vandalia shrugged.
About a ton of mud. A boy's backpack.
Winters felt his throat constrict. Mutant Ninja Turtles? He asked hoarsely.
Yeah.
Winters forced back the knot in his throat that threatened to choke him to death. He'd given it to him. For his 7th birthday. Robbie had been so proud of that backpack. He remembered the way Robbie had inspected it, sober and careful. The way he'd straightened like a soldier when he hauled it onto his back the first time. The way he'd said,
"Thank you, Pa,"
respectfully. The way boys didn't behave anymore. His boy had been special. His hands tightened into fists.
"What else?"
Vandalia shifted on his feet uncomfortably.
"Detective, you really shouldn't even be down here until the primary."
Winters advanced a single step, directing a harsh stare at Russell Vandalia's spindly body in his grimy coveralls.
"What else?"
he gritted from behind clenched teeth. Vandalia stood quietly, not moving a muscle. Winters hated him. Hated the way he moved at his own damn speed, not caring about the important things going on around him. Then Vandalia shrugged again, turned once more to spit in his damn coffee can.
"Your wife's purse."
"Her wallet?"
"Still there. Her driver's license. No cash, no credit cards."
She hadn't had any credit cards. He'd never allowed it. Mary Grace couldn't be trusted with more than $20 at a time, much less a credit card. Her wallet was still there, but empty. She'd been robbed. His gut churned. His boy had been killed over $20.
"What else?" "Her walker, in the back seat. A set of jumper cables in the trunk."
He paused, shrugged again.
"A statue on the floorboard, driver's side."
Winters sharply inhaled, every hair on his neck raising.
"What?"
The garage and all its sundry contents faded to the distant background as he focused on the old man, who remained stubbornly silent. Winters took another step forward, shoving his hands deep in his pockets, the urge to throttle Vandalia almost too strong to resist.
"What did you say?"
"A statue."
Vandalia regarded him warily.
"About 8 inches tall. One of those cheap statues you put in your garden. I've seen him for about $15 at Carolina Pottery. I'm not Catholic, so I can't say for sure who it is. Maybe the Virgin Mary."
"Where is it?"
Winters asked, making his voice steady, impersonal. He didn't want to make the old man suspicious. He needed to get a good look at that statue. He followed the direction Vandalia's shoulder jerked, turning to a table next to the car. Unable to believe his own eyes, barely able to control the feral roar of murderous wrath that flooded him, Winters approached the table.
There it was, that damn statue. She'd given it to her. That motherfucking nurse's aide that couldn't keep her nose out of everybody else's business. The young one, the one that looked at him like he was pond scum, a bottom feeder that didn't deserve to live. The one that coddled Mary Grace like she was some kind of victim. Huh. The only kind of victim Mary Grace had been was of her own stupidity and disobedience. The very existence of that statue was stone proof.
Winters stared in disbelief at the cracks in the clay, vividly remembering the day he'd hauled her sorry ass home from the hospital. The head nurse, the old one, said his wife needed to stay another 3 months, maybe go to some fancy rehabilitation center. Bullshit. What Mary Grace needed was to be home. She'd been lazing in that hospital bed for 3 months while he did her chores at home, while he kept Robbie clean and fed. He was tired of ordering takeout from the chink place down the street, tired of the macaroni and cheese Robbie made every single meal the boy cooked. Tired of dragging his clothes to the corner cleaners to be laundered. Tired of the sorry way Robbie picked up the floor and made the beds. Tired of his boy having to do women's work. She could move, enough to do her chores. Mary Grace needed to be home. It was her place. So he'd brought his wife home. She wanted to keep the statue. Actually thought he would allow her to keep it. To remember that nosy home-wrecking nurse that treated him like he was a monster. The ugly Catholic idol had sat on that table next to her hospital bed for so long, it left behind an area of clean outlined by the dust the nurses never bothered to wipe up. That hospital had been a pigsty. The minute she dragged herself through the front door behind her walker, he grabbed her bag from Robbie's hands and held the statue for her to see. He told her to forget everything she'd heard in the hospital. She was home, his home, where he was in charge. Where he, not some holier-than-thou doctor or do-gooder nurse, made the decisions. He'd expected a little resistance, but she'd surprised him. Her eyes had blazed with hate. So vivid and unexpected, he'd been momentarily taken aback. But the back of his hand wiped her attitude away. And by the time she'd dragged herself back to her feet, the damn statue was in pieces on the kitchen floor. He'd ordered Robbie to sweep the floor, and Robbie obediently picked up the pieces and put them in the kitchen garbage can. And that had been that. He'd never had to look at that god-awful thing again. Until today. The cracks in the clay were wide, the edges chipped. The statue had been reassembled. Glued. His eyes narrowed. Kept. Mary Grace had secretly kept the statue against his strict orders. And now there it sat, next to Robbie's backpack and the other things Russell Vandalia found in the car. He felt a rush of cold, cleansing fury. It could mean only one thing. She and Robbie hadn't been abducted, as he'd feared all these years. The conniving, manipulative lion bitch. She'd planned this. Mary Grace had deliberately run, deliberately taken his boy. But how had the car ended up in Douglas Lake? Why hadn't she taken the statue in her purse? Where had she gone? How had she lived, supported his son? She was a cripple, a gimp. She wasn't capable of any sustained physical effort. She'd never be able to hold a menial job. And she sure as hell wasn't smart enough to get anything better than scrubbing floors. She'd need assistance. Public assistance. Welfare. The thought of his son on welfare was enough to make him sick to his stomach. But that's what she must have done, or they would have starved. But to get assistance, she'd need her license, her social security card, some identification. She'd need those things. So why had she left them behind? Unless... A notion took root. Unbelievable. Impossible. Unless she'd planned to disappear. To become someone else. Stunned, the thought rocked him. Mary Grace wasn't smart enough to stage such an elaborate plan. She wasn't strong enough to carry a laundry basket more than 6 feet at a time. She couldn't have pulled this off alone. She must have had help. It was the only explanation for how she'd completely disappeared. The fury banked as a tiny ember glowed, fanned to life. Hope. If Mary Grace had run away, truly run away from him, she'd taken the boy. She never would have left without the boy. His son was out there, somewhere. He'd find him, and he'd bring him home. And God help Mary Grace, because when he was through with her, only God could. He'd find her, wherever, whoever she was. And then, God damn it, he'd finally finish the job he should have finished years before. Chapter 4. Chicago, Monday, March 5th, 6 p.m.
So how did it go?
Dana asked. Caroline looked over her shoulder as she hung her coat in the closet. Dana lay sprawled on the lame excuse for a sofa Caroline hoped to replace someday. Tom lounged on the floor below her, sharing a fast-dwindling bowl of popcorn. How had it gone? Up until 2:30, everything had gone like heaven. And at 2:30, after Monica Shaw got one look at Max Hunter? Well, everything went south in a big-time hurry. She was hurt. Humiliated. And she didn't want to talk about it.
You're still here?
Caroline narrowed her eyes suspiciously.
Are you sick? Are you coming down with that little boy's strep? No, Mommy, I'm not sick. See?
Dana stuck her tongue out.
Ah.
Caroline rolled her eyes.
Gross, Dana. Next time swallow the popcorn first.
Tom chuckled and held up a hand blindly to be high-fived.
Good one, Dana. I thought so.
Dana smacked Tom's hand.
No, I'm not still here. I ate your porridge, broke a few chairs, slept in your bed, then I used your shower and your toothbrush before I went down to City Hall to try to solicit some more operating funds. Then I came by afterwards to give you unconditional support in case your new boss is intolerable. Is he?
Caroline glared as she passed the sofa on her way to the kitchen. From the smell of the room, Tom had shoved a frozen pizza in the oven.
You used my toothbrush? Tom, I want to see your math homework. Anything under a B and your camping trip is canceled, young man. I got a B plus, Mom,
Tom answered quietly, the laughter gone from his voice.
Well, good. I'm glad.
She sniffed the air again.
Did you take the plastic off that pizza before you put it in the oven?
Tom winced and jumped to his feet in a graceful movement that seemed at odds with his gangly height.
I think so. I'll check. Do that.
Caroline shook her head and pushed Tom's stack of school books to one side of the dinette with more force than necessary.
And when you're done, can you move these books to your room?
Tom gave her a quizzical look.
Sure, Mom. What's wrong?
Caroline sat down at the table, tired and angry, and hurt. And jealous? Yes, that too, she was forced to admit. Which made her even angrier.
Nothing.
Uh-oh. She turned her head to one side, skewering him with another glare.
What's that supposed to mean?
Just uh-oh. Tom grinned engagingly as he shut the oven door.
That burning smell was just cheese that fell on the electrical element. No plastic.
His grin met its mark, extinguishing at least a portion of the anger that had been bubbling all afternoon. A bit of guilt set in. She hated to snap at Tom. He was a good kid.
That's good. What did you mean by uh-oh?
Tom sighed and looked to Dana for assistance. When it appeared none was forthcoming, he squared his shoulders, prepared to face his mother like a man.
When you come in all mad, push my books out of the way, don't say, how was your day, honey?
His voice sing-songed in a passable imitation of Caroline's drawl.
And when I ask what's wrong, you say, nothing.
He grounded out in grouchy tones and shrugged.
It's bad news for me. Either something's really wrong, in which case I'm about to get worried, or it's,
he cleared his throat delicately.
Time to be running to the corner store for cheap chocolate in the jumbo size.
Dana laughed as she unfolded her long legs from the sofa.
He's got you pegged to a lousy tea, Carol.
Her eyes danced.
Honey.
Caroline's lips twitched, then she let out a laugh, her first since 2:30 that afternoon when Shawclaw sashayed in to meet Max Hunter.
You guys ought to be happy I love you.
Tom sighed in overly dramatic mock relief.
Then I don't need to get the 2-pound bag of M&Ms. It's almost Easter. They should have the almond ones in pretty colors now. You're a cruising young man.
Caroline shook her finger at him.
Come here.
He complied and gave her a crushing hug.
You're okay now?
He murmured, concern showing through his spotty bravado.
Right as rain. How long before the pizza's done? 15 minutes.
Astute beyond his years, he nodded.
Yes'm, I'll take my books to my room so you can tell Dana why you're really mad.
Dana delivered a fake punch to his shoulder.
And don't come back till I ring the dinner bell. We don't have a dinner bell.
Dana shrugged.
There you go.
She smiled at his back, then took the chair next to Caroline's.
For the record, I did not use your toothbrush. I stole a new one from your closet.
She folded her arms on the table.
So how was your day, honey?
Caroline rolled her eyes again.
Fine. So, is he 500 years old and a grouchy old sourpuss?
Caroline glared at her.
No. Okay,
Dana responded.
95 and takes his teeth out at inopportune moments?
Caroline bit her twitching lip.
No.
She tugged the band from the end of her braid and slowly worked it loose.
He's...
She shook her head, taking a small pleasure from the way her hair felt falling free.
He's something else. An axe murderer? No. Then tell me, for God's sake. I'm sitting on needles here.
Caroline rolled her eyes heavenward.
Do you remember that Diet Coke commercial?
Dana sat back in her chair, stunned.
No way. Way? Dr. Maximilian Alexander Hunter is a cross between that Diet Coke guy and Jack Lord from Hawaii 5-0. Ooh, I always thought he was sexy with the way his hair fell down on his forehead and how he wore those black suits without breaking a sweat, even though it was 400 degrees outside in Hawaii. Proved he was a real man with a capital M. Book 'em, Dano. So, if your new boss is eye candy, why the long face?
Caroline narrowed her eyes, feeling petulant and just a little evil.
I'm not sure.
Dana pushed her mouth into a sympathetic pout that was all but ruined by the laughter in her brown eyes.
Poor, poor Caroline. Does he make your heart go pitter-pat?
Caroline shook her head.
I wish. Jackhammer? Oh, boy,
she whistled when Caroline nodded.
That can't sit well with you. Why would you say that?
Dana tapped her chin with her forefinger.
Let's see. Caroline Stewart, who has successfully avoided any entanglement with a man for as long as I've known her, suddenly she's face to face with potent sex appeal. I bet he liked you, too. That would make it worse.
Caroline sat back in her chair and crossed her arms over her chest.
I don't avoid men,
she protested.
Yeah, you and the senior group at the Rotary Club. Wade, Eli, Dr. Lee. They don't count, Caro. They're safe, father figures, too old to be any threat. You've surrounded yourself with non-threatening men from day one. Not that anyone blames you, of course.
Of course,
Caroline muttered.
And now a very sexy man is thrust into your safe little world? Your heart goes pitter-pat? Thunk, thunk, thunk,
Caroline corrected darkly. It was pounding again, just remembering the intensity of his expression when he looked her up and down, the way her own body had responded.
Fine, then. Thunk, thunk. Now you are tempted. You don't want to be tempted because you're scared. Caroline, that's just foolish, you know. Not all men are bad.
If only it were that simple.
Has anyone ever told you that you're annoying when you meddle? You and Daly. Doesn't matter. I'm right on this. Is he nice?
Glumly, Caroline nodded.
Did he notice you too?
Caroline shrugged.
He looked at me.
Dana leaned back in her chair, her brown eyes alive with speculation.
How?
Caroline closed her eyes.
Like I was the only woman in the world,
she thought.
Like I was desirable, pretty. Like he wanted me. Little Miss Naive, like you could tempt a man like Max Hunter. Right.
Dana whistled.
Wow. Did you blush like that when he looked at you?
Caroline felt her stomach turn over.
Probably. So what's wrong with that? Some men like the Pollyanna gee-golly-whiz will-you-take-me-to-the-sock-hop look.
Caroline swallowed. She would not, under any circumstances, allow Maximilian Hunter to upset her. It just wasn't gonna happen.
Oh. So then what happened?
Dana asked, her voice rife with understanding.
Shaw. Oh, for crying out loud, Caro. No, I'm serious. You should have seen her, Dana. She walked in demanding to see him before her scheduled appointment. He was still in with Wade, so I knocked to see if he's finishing with Wade soon, and she pushes by me, all regal-like, dismisses me like I'm the servant of the house, then gives Max the eye. The evil eye?
Dana had leaned forward, elbows on the table, her chin propped on one fist.
No, the sexual eye,
Caroline demonstrated, then slumped in her chair. It had been so humiliating. Her heart hadn't even slowed down from those surface-of-the-sun stares in his office when Monica came in and taught her a thing or two about what men really want. One look at Max Hunter, and Monica went into chase mode, fluffing her platinum blonde hair and pulling her shoulders back in her tight-fitting silk suit, jutting her breasts out for Max's fullest appreciation. As always, when faced with Monica Shaw's natural elegance, her own self-esteem plunged. Dana winced.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. So did your Dr. Hunter take the bait? How could he not? He's a man, after all.
That was the understatement of the century. Max Hunter was the quintessential man.
Caroline, you are not being fair, to him or to yourself. Not all men are suckers for a pretty face, and Shaw's isn't even that pretty. She's gorgeous, Dana, and you know it. She has bad skin and hides it with $50 a bottle concealer.
Caroline smiled, glad for Dana's loyalty, however skewed, and managed to pull the entire situation back into perspective.
Doesn't matter anyway.
This time Dana narrowed her eyes.
Why the hell not? Because I'm not in the market for a man, not now, not ever.
It was the truth. It would have to be.
Caroline.
Caroline held up one hand to silence Dana while rubbing her forehead with the other. A headache was brewing.
We've had this conversation before. It would be wrong for me to start a relationship with someone knowing I'm unavailable. Bigamy is still against the law.
Dana pursed her lips.
So is beating your wife within an inch of her life. So two wrongs don't make a right?
Dana finished impatiently.
Do I have to throttle you to make you listen to reason? Just because a man's interested in you doesn't mean you have to marry him. Go on a date. Have a good time. Kiss a little. Pet a little. A little sex isn't bad either. Geez, Caroline.
Caroline smacked her hand on the table, cutting Dana off in mid-argument. Cutting off the mental images that had sprung to life simply by the words a little sex. There would be no such thing as a little sex with a man like Max Hunter.
Enough. I will not challenge Monica's staked claim, or anyone else's for that matter. I will not be interested in Max Hunter.
She drew a breath, held it, then let it out.
I stopped by Hanover House at lunch, and you'll be happy to know Cody's fever broke this morning after you left. Dr. Lee says he's going to be just fine. But I'm not so sure about his mother. She looks to me like she just might go back to her husband.
Dana locked her arms across her chest, her jaw stubbornly jutting to one side.
You're changing the subject, Carol. And like it or not, it's not your business if she stays or goes back to her husband.
Caroline frowned. They had this argument every time a woman left the safety of Hanover House to return to her abusive partner.
Are you staying for dinner or not?
Dana sighed, releasing the stronghold she had on herself and raked her freed hand through her short hair.
Sure. I'm a sucker for plastic pizza, and I still have nothing in my cupboards.
Caroline pushed away from the table.
Then I'll make a salad. I swear you'd have scurvy in a week if it weren't for me making you eat some vegetables. Caroline?
Caroline turned in the doorway of the little kitchen, feeling another spurt of annoyance at the smug, knowing look on her best friend's face. That was the problem with best friends. They always knew you way too well.
What? Black suits you. And don't forget to touch up your roots before work tomorrow.
State Bureau of Investigation, Raleigh, North Carolina, Monday, March 5th, 7 p.m. Special Agent Stephen Thatcher of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation had one hell of a headache, a consistent, nagging headache. She was named Aunt Helen, his mother's sister. She meant well, she really did, and she hadn't always been a headache. She was, in truth, his favorite aunt, and he loved her dearly. When he was a red-headed, freckle-faced boy of 8, she'd take him fishing. Damn, but that woman could cast like a pro. She balked at cleaning her own catch, but she made up for it by frying up whatever he cleaned. When he was a gangly, red-headed, pimply, and freckle-faced adolescent of 13, she taught him to dance and how to pin a corsage on a girl's dress without practicing acupuncture or getting slapped in the face. When he was an awkward, nervous groom and father-to-be at 18, she tied his bow tie and told him he was doing the right thing. She'd cooed over and helped change the diapers of every one of his 3 boys. And she'd held his hand when at 33 he put his wife on the ground. That was 3 years ago. She'd moved in with them before the boys' tears were dry and taken care of them. She still took care of them all. Cooked, cleaned, made sure the boys' socks were bleached white, and even matched. Made sure he didn't wear a paisley tie with a herringbone jacket. sang lullabies to his youngest son, and tucked him into bed with a kiss and a bedtime story of faraway lands and dragons. She fished with his middle son, and taught his oldest to dance and pin corsages on girls. Yes, she was his favorite aunt, and he loved her dearly. Yet she was the cause of the pain shooting behind his eyes at this very moment. Because now, at 36, with his red hair tamed to what Aunt Helen called strawberry blonde, his freckles faded, and his ring finger bare, he was an available male, and his children needed a mother. He should know. Aunt Helen said so. Daily. At this very moment, in fact. And she had just the right girl. He rolled his eyes. She always had just the right girl. He leaned back in his chair and rubbed his eyes. It wasn't any use. The headache just stayed and stayed. Helen had the tenacity of that damn pink battery bunny. And the fact that what she wanted most was the very thing he'd vowed to avoid at all costs. Well, that would just be one more snag in the tangle of his life. Stephen switched the phone to his other ear and grabbed the file he'd been reading when she called. No, Helen. And, oh, I do not want to go out with your friend's niece's cousin. I don't care if she did win the local beauty pageant when she was 17. I don't care if she's so sweet that she makes Mother Teresa look like Hitler. The answer is still no.
She has her own bass boat, Helen wheedled, with a depth finder and a GPS.
Stephen sat up in his chair. Really? He narrowed his eyes. You wouldn't be lying to me, would you, Helen? This might be an out with fringe benefits, a way to keep Helen off his back for a few months and squeeze in some legitimate recreation at the same time.
200 horses.
Stephen bit his lip. He hated Helen's blind dates. Hated them. But hell, the woman had a depth finder and a global positioning system and a boat with a 200-horse motor. How bad could she be? One, maybe two dates with the beauty queen, and Helen would lay off the matchmaking, maybe until fall if all the cards fell his way. Okay, okay, give me your number.
I thought the boat would do the trick,
Helen said, obviously taking great satisfaction from her victory.
You're a hard man to matchmake, Stephen.
I know. The number? With an inward sigh, he wrote it on his desk blotter. I'll try to call her tomorrow.
Why not tonight?
Don't push it, Helen. Stephen massaged the back of his neck. Besides, I've got calls to return. Don't hold dinner for me, but tell Nikki I'll be home in time to tuck him in. He returned four of the six calls, checking each one off his list. Two more to go, then home to a warmed-over dinner and hopefully a cold beer. And his boys. Always his boys. Stephen? Stephen looked up to find his boss leaning against the door jamb of his office door, his normally jovial face creased in a frown, a manila folder under one arm. Stephen placed the phone receiver back in its cradle. What's up? New case in from Asheville. Special Agent in Charge Lenny Farrell laid the folder on Stephen's desk blotter dead center. Farrell was a stickler for detail, sometimes to the point of annoying everyone in his command. But he was a good man, a good leader, and Stephen respected him. I need you to go down there tomorrow and check it out. Stephen opened the file, scanned the first few pages. I remember this one vaguely. Wife and son of a cop missing when? 7 years ago now? How'd you get this file so fast? They just pulled up the car yesterday morning. He squinted up at Farrell. Why isn't the Asheville field office responding to this? It's their jurisdiction. What's up, Lenny? Farrell shrugged. I got a call right at noon from the head of the Asheville office. He was in the district attorney's office 7 years ago, and he thought the husband did it back then. But there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge him. He's concerned this'll get brushed under the carpet again.
Apparently enough of the Asheville PD have personal history with the husband to make him concerned about conflict of interest within the Asheville office. Farrell hesitated, then straightened his spine. I also got a call from the investigating detective, retired now. He and I go back a lot of years. He also thought the husband did it. He wants the right thing done by the wife and boy this time around.
Stephen regarded Farrell for a long moment. Did the investigating officer call you or the Asheville field office first? Farrell looked distinctly uncomfortable.
Me first. I recommended he go through channels to call the field office and get them involved. He did, and the field office asked us to get involved.
Stephen glanced down at the file, then back up at Farrell.
Your dad's a retired cop out of Asheville PD, isn't he?
Farrell jerked his head in what Stephen interpreted as a nod. That was enough. Stephen massaged his temples, feeling his headache worsen. He'd been through cases like this one before, and the outcome was rarely pretty. The SBI was rarely welcomed by local law enforcement with open arms. Usually at least one local cop viewed SBI special agents as trespassers on local turf. Truth was, SBI resources were better equipped to investigate cases that, thank God, weren't daily occurrences in North Carolina's small towns. Nevertheless, his presence was likely to be considered outsider interference by the local police.
Is local law enforcement aware I'm coming in on their investigation?
Farrell nodded.
Actually, the lieutenant in charge at Asheville PD gave the field office a call this morning.
He checked his notepad.
Her name is Lieutenant Antoinette Ross, goes by Tony. Well respected by the Asheville field office. She asked for SBI support, so you can at least count on cooperation at the top.
Stephen smirked. Before or after your father talked to her? Farrell shook his head with a slight smile.
You'll have to ask her that question.
Stephen scanned the file once again. There was precious little information.
No bodies found?
Nope. Farrell perched on the corner of his desk.
And there was no evidence of foul play when the wife and the boy first disappeared 7 years ago.
Stephen frowned at the troubled look in Farrell's eyes.
And now?
Farrell gave a facial shrug.
That's what I want you to find out.
Stephen closed the file.
I'll head out first thing in the morning.
He allowed himself a final smirk up at Farrell. Oh, and I'll give your daddy your regards when I talk to him. Farrell stood and headed for the door.
Make sure my mama offers you some of her sweet potato pie. It's the best.
Chicago, Monday, March 5th, 9 p.m. Max relaxed behind the wheel of his car, pleasantly exhausted from his first day at Carrington College, finding the drive to his house comfortably familiar. It was still hard to think of it as his own house. It had belonged to Grandma Hunter since before he and his brothers and sisters were born. Situated west of Chicago in what was still rolling farmland, it was old and drafty and massive, and absolutely wonderful. He smiled as he turned onto his own road. He'd hung from those tree limbs as a boy, raced up and down the road, David and Peter at his side, Catherine at their heels, Elizabeth crying because they'd left her behind again. He'd missed them, his family. He hadn't realized how much until Kathy called to ask him to come home. Her oldest was taking a job in Virginia, and the house would be empty again. The call from Dean Whitfield had truly been providential, just as he'd told Caroline Stewart that morning. Now, he thought, she had been a very pleasant surprise. All the history department secretaries he'd known had been gray, 50-ish, and grandmotherly. Caroline was anything but. A wave of arousal surged at the memory of her rounded curves, of the charming way she blushed when she realized he'd been studying her. She was everything he'd been looking for. Beautiful, compassionate, obviously intelligent. Too bad she didn't seem to have the same assessment of her value that he did.
If she had, Monica Shaw would never have been able to extinguish the light from her eyes so quickly. Fury had spiked inside him, and it had taken every ounce of restraint to keep from telling Monica Shaw to go to hell. The elderly professor Wade Grayson warned him about Shaw. He'd been right. But watching Monica wave Caroline away as if she were a servant and Shaw the queen lit a possessiveness in him, a sharp need to protect Caroline that took him by surprise. Remembering hours later, the feeling still took him by surprise. Surprise took an upward surge as he pulled into his driveway, finding a classic T-bird taking up more than half the width. "David," he muttered, joy and annoyance competing. He parked his car as far to the left of the T-bird as he could, ending up partially on the snow-covered grass. The recent spring thaw teased, leaving piles of slushy ice in its wake. He'd have a shoe full of slush before he got into the house. But joy won out. David was here, and Max had missed him. Max found the door unlocked, and the sizzle and aroma of stir-fry met his ears and nose. He dropped his briefcase on the hardwood floor of the foyer and hung his overcoat on one of the pegs Grandpa Hunter had hammered into the wall 60 years ago. He'd finally come home.
"David! In the kitchen!"
Max let his nose lead the way and found his brother dramatically shaken vegetables in a large wok over the gas stove. David looked up with a grin, and the years seemed to melt away.
"About time you got home."
He dropped the long handle of the wok to fold Max in a bear hug. The seconds ticked as the brothers held tight in a true embrace. Similar in size and weight, they'd made a formidable pair once upon a time. And despite the 2 years separating them, they'd always been a pair. With a last hard squeeze, David let go first and turned back to his cooking. Max looked over David's shoulder at the sizzling vegetables.
"How long have you been here?"
"Since me and Ma finished your grocery shopping 3 hours ago."
David rolled his eyes to the ceiling as if praying for patience, and Max laughed.
"Your cabinets are officially stocked."
"Better you than me." Max's heart softened. "She went to a lot of trouble for me."
"She's glad to have you home, finally."
David did something magical with his wrist, and all the vegetables took a dangerous slide, miraculously ending up back in the wok. Max took a fond look around him. The kitchen was garish and old, enormous goldenrod and lime vegetables adorning the walls. Grandma Hunter hung the wallpaper when Max was a boy, and he'd hated it as much then as he did now. But it was as much a part of this place as the horseshoe hung over the door and the antique table and cane-back chairs. Ma called them antiques. Grandma had just called them old.
"I'm glad to be home. That smells good."
David smirked.
"I thought you had a dinner meeting."
"Appetizers." It had been a steak, but, well, that had been hours before. With a flourish, David served, then joined him at the old table.
"Sit and enjoy. You got some calls while you were gone."
Max's back tightened against the cane-back chair.
"Who?" "Your realtor in Denver. You got an offer on your condo. A good one. I told her to take it."
Max's eyes widened in shocked disbelief.
"You told her what?"
David chuckled.
"You're still so easy, Max. I told her I'd give you the message. But you should take it. It's a great offer."
He paused.
"Then somebody named Ed called."
"And?" Ed was the one friend he'd made in the years he'd lived in Denver. David bit his lip, hesitating.
"He said the wedding went off without a hitch."
Max drew a deep breath, then let it out as a sigh.
"Well, I guess that's..."